one thing people say is, boy, you've written this book. It's so critical of Western medicine. Don't you get depressed, you know, with these diseases? And actually, I'm not depressed. It's actually, I feel hopeful. I feel like we're entering in a new era of healthcare where the patient is in charge and the doctor is just, you know, giving advice, because like we talked about, lifestyle is not something a doctor can do for me.
Hey, critical thinkers, welcome to this new episode of Healthy and Awake podcast. Here we question the conventional, explore the unconventional, and seek truth in health and wellness. I'm your host, Mike Vera, and today we're speaking with the returning guest, Dr. Robert Lufkin. Now, I'm trying to make these intros shorter, so I'm just going to give you the bullet points on who he is, and we'll get right into it. Dr. Robert Lufkin is a physician and medical school professor at UCLA and USC. He's the author of Lies I Taught in Medical School, which is the main focus of our discussion today. He focuses on metabolic health and longevity. He's the host of the Health Longevity Secrets podcast. He's developed the widely used Lufkin needle for MR-compatible biopsies. He's the former president of the Society of Magnetic Resonance Imaging. He's named one of the 100 most creative people in Los Angeles by Buzz Magazine. And overall, he's a really fun and friendly guy to talk to who's very knowledgeable in his field. And I think you're really going to enjoy this one because it's a nice addition to the previous discussions on carnivore and vegan, where Dr. Lufkin really emphasizes a ketogenic approach. So it gives you more information to determine what's the best dietary approach for you. So without further ado, here we go. Dr. Robert Lufkin, what's new and exciting since the last time we spoke?
Hey, Mike, it's great to be back with you. This is so much fun. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. I've been reading your book, which I have here, Lies I Taught in Medical School. What an incredible read. Seriously, so much useful. You know what? I talk to a lot of doctors. I read a lot about food. I have to admit, part of me was skeptical I would learn anything new just because I'm in this field. I learned so much from your book, so I really appreciate it. And again, congrats on the New York Times bestseller list.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much. As we were saying, that's a lot of luck, you know, getting on that. And we were lucky, you know, fortunate. And thanks for everyone's support as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you are probably aware that one of the things that can lead to teaching confusing things or teaching lies in medical school, as you put it, is the role of propaganda, as I refer to it. So I'm wondering, what are your thoughts on the role of pharmaceutical propaganda in the landscape we face today?
It's huge. I mean, my mom was a dietitian, and famously, you know, I know from going to conferences with her and everything that the nutrition industry is basically, nutrition education is funded by junk food makers, big food makers, you know, with McDonald's and Coke advertising there. Well, it gets worse with medical education, because medical education is largely funded by pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, for better or worse, that influences, you know, I mean, what could go wrong, right? And I think it's not like people want to get up and do harm. You know, I think, in my heart, most people don't wake up and want to harm another person. But, the system, the influences, both conscious and unconscious, these, you know, financial and other pernicious incentives, you know, drive people to do things which are harmful. And they may not realize it at the time, but, you know, that's the world we're in. And it's a big problem, and it's getting worse.
But we do have these regulatory agencies that are supposed to look out for us and protect us. And yet people continue to get less and less healthy. At least it seems that way. So what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, let's start off. We have first independent, trusted institutions about different diseases, the American Heart Association, the American Diabetes Association, and, you know, numerous other ones. And the problem is these institutions are funded by sponsors that, in my opinion, in particular, those two and others as well, but have corrupted their message. For example, the American Heart Association to this day puts a label on junk food cereals that says heart healthy, like, you know, Fruit Loops and things like that. They also recommend the use of seed oils like canola oil or vegetable oil as a heart healthy choice. And you have to wonder, why would they do that? Well, first of all, seed oils do lower cholesterol, lower LDL cholesterol. But, you know, as we're learning, there's much more to heart disease than LDL cholesterol. And in fact, it's one of the weaker players, in my opinion. So why would they do that? Well, if you look back in history, in the middle of the 20th century, the American Heart Association was really funded by a large grant from Procter & Gamble, which is a food maker. Procter & Gamble, though, famously worked with scientists in the beginning of the 20th century who were developing machine lubricants for German U-boats from cottonseed and soybean as a replacement for whale oil that was coming in short supply. And these machine lubricants were pretty effective. They could be made from heavily, heavily processed vegetable oils, but it was discovered that you could feed them to people and people would actually eat them. And Procter & Gamble took this. They famously branded it. They called it Crisco. And it was
the drug company, Procter & Gamble.
Yeah, Procter & Gamble food, really, originally.
Oh, okay.
Now, you know, now many things. But they
I didn't realize that. Okay.
Crisco was their product. And then they gave a grant to the American Heart Association in the middle of the 20th century, which to this day still recommends seed oils, which, you know, I believe, and many, many experts believe, are pro-inflammatory, and they actually make heart disease worse. And there's some controlled studies that actually show that, like the Minnesota study and some others. That's the American Heart Association. The American Diabetes Association, they, on their website, type 2 diabetes, which is the kind of diabetes we're talking about, it's reaching, just like heart disease, it's reaching epidemic proportions. You know, these chronic diseases, fully 80% of our healthcare resources are now being spent on them, and it's only growing. But type 2 diabetes is a problem with the metabolism of sugar, particularly carbohydrates, starches, and, you know, other refined sugars. And when we consume these, it raises our insulin to control the sugar spikes, and this high insulin eventually over time causes what's called insulin resistance. And that's literally what type 2 diabetes is, because then you need to take drugs and you need to take extra insulin to get the same effect because your body's not able to produce enough of it because of the resistance. So type 2 diabetes is the American Diabetic Association recommends on their website recipes for diabetics. And curiously, the recipes have carbohydrates in them. They have sugar. And they just say, well, cover it with insulin, which means give extra insulin when you eat the sugar. And you have to ask yourself, why would you do that? Because type 2 diabetes, it's not only an acute problem of sugar metabolism, it's a chronic progressive disease that leads to number one cause of surgical amputations today is type 2 diabetes. Number one cause of kidney failure is type 2 diabetes. Number one cause of, you know, retinal blindness in young people, on and on, heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, mental illness. Type 2 diabetes is, you know, a driver in there. And the thing is, when you recommend treating your sugar with insulin and eating sugar, type 2 diabetes is a chronic progressive disease. Interestingly, though, studies have now shown and controlled studies have shown that if you, instead of just increasing your insulin dose and taking drugs, if you just eliminate carbohydrates from your diet, in other words, go on what's called a low carb diet or what is a nutritionally metabolically healthy diet, the majority of people can actually reverse their type 2 diabetes and go off medicines. But the interesting thing happens when you control diabetes with insulin, it's a chronic progressive disease and all these things happen. When you control diabetes with diet and lifestyle, you're actually reversing it at its root cause and it doesn't progress. In other words, you've stopped the amputations, the blindness, all the other stuff, which with patients who are treating it with insulin, those things in many cases largely continue. So back to the American Diabetic Association, why on earth would they recommend that instead of nutrition? Well, I posted this on social media. On their website, where they recommend the recipes with high sugar, the sponsor is DaVita Corporation for that particular one. DaVita Corporation is basically the leading, their business sector is dialysis, which people in renal failure need. And if if you eat sugar, if you're a diabetic and you eat sugar and you cover with insulin, you're going to be at risk for dialysis down the line. So there are these corrupting influences, but it gets worse. Those are independent scientific organizations. Now we have literally the federal government, the FDA, the USDA, that also influences health policy. Let's take the USDA. They famously recommended and designed the food pyramid, which your audience is probably familiar with. It's a pyramid, and the base is the number of food, the food you're supposed to eat the most of. And then as you go higher and higher, you eat less and less of that. And it's actually, even though it's a U.S. institution, it's followed worldwide, really. We set the tone for that. And because it's a U.S. policy, it sets the guidelines for school lunch programs for our children, for our veterans, for our military, for prisons. And basically, you know, anyone who's designing a nutrition program looks to the food pyramid in the USDA. Well, famously, Nina Teicholz, in a recent article, analyzed the conflicts of interest in the most recent USDA committee that designed the most recent food pyramid, and over 90% of these people were conflicted with big food manufacturers, i.e. junk food manufacturers, so that they have a conflict of interest with that. And actually, if you look at the food pyramid, it sort of makes sense. The bottom row is what they're telling us we should eat the most of is all junk food. It's basically cereals, grains, flour, you know, baked goods, stuff like that, which would benefit these companies, but actually drives not only type 2 diabetes, but all the metabolic basis disease of all these. So back to your original question. Sorry for the long answer, but
you're fine.
But our institutions are influenced by the sponsors that sponsor them, both independent institutions and the federal government. And it even goes down to the scientific papers that, you know, our gold standard for evidence in science is not, you know, it's not what Dr. Lufkin writes in his book or what, you know, Dr. So-and-so says or what my aunt says or my mom says, but our gold standard for evidence in science is studies, published studies, peer-reviewed studies. And these can be, you know, associative studies, which don't show causality, but they're, you know, epidemiological studies that we can infer associations from. And then the ultimate gold standard is the controlled, prospective, randomized trial where we can actually infer causality and not just associations. But even these studies are corrupted. There's, you know, some recent articles have shown some of the authors of these studies have now been caught falsifying scientific evidence. One of them was a leader in neuroscience and Alzheimer's research, and sort of the mistaken hypothesis, I believe it's mistaken, that Alzheimer's is driven by beta amyloid as the primary cause. I think it's associated with beta amyloid, but I don't think it's causal. But he wrote about this, and he famously was caught faking the data with Photoshop and stuff and had to retract it. But
wow.
But it gets even worse. The people who published the studies, and I know because my lab has received, you know, literally millions of dollars from pharmaceutical companies and drug maker and device makers and federal government to do research. And we know when your research is funded by a certain organization, even though you try to, we all try to just get at the truth, this is a consequence of it is that it's going to influence us. And there's a great paper that came out that analyzed peer-reviewed studies like this about junk food, the harm of junk food. And they found that when the studies were funded by junk food companies, only 10% found that junk food was harmful. But when they were independent studies, that, you know, 90% of the studies found that junk food was harmful. But, you know, it makes perfect sense. So we have to look at the sponsors of our institutions. We have to look at who's sponsoring the research and the peer-reviewed papers. It gets very, very complicated.
So basically, if someone has diabetes or they're trying to prevent diabetes, to take the information from these prominent agencies and institutions with a grain of salt, if their diet permits that. But you mentioned explicitly eliminating carbs might be the solution there. And I've heard things like eliminating carbs, it could be bad for your thyroid. And of course, if you eliminate carbs, it would follow that you're eating more fat, which could implicate your gallbladder, plus more protein, which could implicate your kidneys. So is this just more of those lies coming from the institution, or how should we think about that?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a really important question. If we think about our diets, because diets are, you know, really confusing, but if you simplify it to just the macronutrients, and your audience, I know you've talked about fat and protein being the two essential macronutrients. So in other words, if we don't eat these, our body can't synthesize them and we'll die, right? And then there's this third macronutrient called carbohydrates, which we talked about includes glucose, sugar, starches, flour, rice. And interestingly, carbohydrates are not required. In fact, our body will synthesize glucose, and there are actually, you know, several human civilizations that exist on virtually no carbohydrates, and they do fine. They've, you know, done fine. There are no human civilizations that can exist on zero fat or zero protein. Okay, so carbs are not essential. Now, when you mentioned a low carb diet, or what I talked about, a low carb diet, generally what happens of the three macronutrients, it's most people, to keep it simple, you keep proteins constant, right, in the middle, for a number of reasons, but let's leave that aside now. So generally, a low carb diet, what you hinted at, means a high fat diet, and a low fat diet, which we've been told to eat for the last 70 years, means a high carb diet. So the trick is, I believe a low carbohydrate diet is healthy because the carbs are going to drive the insulin, which drives mTOR, which drives metabolic disease, which drives insulin resistance, and all those things.
You've tried the apps, you've signed up for gym memberships, and you've given it your all, yet you're still not where you want to be. What's missing? Accountability and expert guidance. As a board-certified health and wellness coach, I provide the personalized support that you need to finally make real, lasting progress. Making a solid health routine last and stay consistent is hard work, but you don't have to do it alone. Let's work together to turn your health goals into reality. Are you ready to transform? Start your journey at Avantia Health Optimization by clicking the link in the show notes or by going to mikevera.com, where you can try your first session for just $1. Now back to the show.
But when we replace it with fats, we have to be careful that they're healthy fats. And like we hinted at before, healthy fats means either saturated fats, animal fats, or things like avocado oil, coconut oil, stable oils, not the seed oils, which are very pro-inflammatory, unstable at high heat, even though everything's fried in them, and pro-oxidative. So the metabolically healthy diet that I recommend and that is effective in patients with type 2 diabetes is a low-carbohydrate diet. Interestingly, it's also effective in, you know, some patients with mental illness, and there's a whole revolution in that. It's also effective in some patients, not all patients, but some patients with Alzheimer's disease. Go figure that out. It's also helpful for cancer patients in some cases, a ketogenic diet, and also for cardiovascular disease and blood pressure, hypertension, and certainly obesity as well. So there's something about this metabolically healthy diet where we lower the carbohydrates and raise the fats, but we stick with healthy fats, that it has many beneficial effects.
So I actually recently spoke with two people who maybe you're familiar with, Dr. Sean Baker, who promotes the carnivore diet. And just to present a balanced approach, I also spoke with Dr. Joel Kahn, who's prominent in the vegan space. And I'm just here trying to figure things out because they're making two totally different arguments. Oh, yeah. You know, the carnivore diet is higher in protein and fat. Dr. Kahn himself says that he eats a high carb diet, but you know, he presents it as being the key to health and longevity. And here you are saying that, you know, maybe low carb or keto, which could be the same or could be different depending on how you approach it. It sounds like you're saying maybe keto is the way to go.
Yeah. And let me just say, I know Joel and I know Sean. They're both very, very good people. And I think, you know, reasonable people can agree to disagree. And we're all just trying to figure it out in a very complex world. Let me also say that Sean is about, you know, carnivore diet. And I believe that, you know, carnivore and vegan have almost been politicized. You know, it's like too many things in our society. You know, there's people become tribal about it. Well, I have to say, and I say this all the time, that I love my vegan friends. I was vegan for a while. I love my carnivore friends and everybody in between. And I believe you can be very healthy or very unhealthy on any of these diets, anywhere between vegan all the way to carnivore. And for me, the secret is, or the way to health is avoiding junk foods. And junk foods happen to be, you know, carbohydrates, practically all carbohydrates, also the seed oils and also grains. So it, by taking what I believe is a healthy diet, you're going to be towards the ketogenic side. You know, if you will be in ketosis. It tends to be a low carbohydrate diet, but it's not about vegan or carnivore. You can do a low carb diet on a vegan thing. I know from experience, it's much more challenging to be healthy as a vegan because there are some macronutrients that plants don't provide. So we have to watch out for, you know, B12 and other things. And also, I also know from experience, there's a lot more plant-based junk food than there is animal-based junk food. There's still animal-based junk food, but, you know, it's much easier to go off the rails eating plants than it is eating meat. But that aside, that's kind of my position on it. And, you know, I guess if I had to align, I'm more aligned with Sean in his position about the low carbohydrates and Joel. You know, Joel and I have had conversations about this, and, you know, we just disagree. There's a very long history of cardiology, and that's Joel's background, but people, you know, heart specialists believing that a low fat, high carbohydrate diet is the secret to health. And that's been the, you know, basically the national policy for the last 50 years. And I believe those recommendations are one of the things that have gotten us into the place where we are with this tsunami of chronic diseases, which are based on metabolic dysfunction, including cardiovascular disease.
Well, for what it's worth, after our initial discussion around a year ago, before I think your book was even out, you made me think very seriously about food in a way that I hadn't thought about before. And I'll admit, full disclosure here, I've struggled with my own processed food addiction. Chocolate chip cookies by far are my biggest weakness. And so after we talked, I started messing around with different diets. I tried a more plant-based approach, and I'm not a fan of vegetables, if I'm being honest. I tried the keto approach, which I actually felt really good. I was eating lots of guacamole. I would even drink a small cup of olive oil. I was trying to do everything to get it right. And I found that tough to implement. And more recently, I'm on the carnivore diet right now, which I found easiest because I've always loved steak. I could never get bored of steak. I just love it. So I have felt a lot better cutting out all those carbs. My addiction and those cravings and tendencies are effectively gone. raw milk has actually been a big help, because whenever I've had sugar cravings, I drink some raw milk and it's delicious. Maybe we can talk about that later. But first, I'm wondering, based on all the issues that we've discussed so far, we're in some new territory now with RFK Jr., who's going to have a big role in the new administration. He's making all kinds of claims about what he wants to fix. Are you optimistic about the future of the health of the country with RFK Jr. having more control?
Yeah, let me say, first of all, my podcast, my brand, I'm intentionally not political. Yeah. You know, I have my own political views, but you know, nobody cares. They're mine. So I really think health should not be a political issue. And, you know, if the Republicans are going to embrace healthcare, then, you know, I'm all for it. If the Democrats are going to embrace it, I'm all for it. You know, I think it shouldn't be a partisan issue about, you know, make America healthy again. Well, that's something that everybody should get behind. Now, having said that, you know, this incoming administration, for the first time that I can remember, I think ever, we've had metabolic health mentioned on a national political platform. People actually using the word seed oils and you know, beginning to question many of the things we've talked about here and, you know, so far in this program. So, you know, I'm optimistic. I mean, things need to change. We can't keep going the way we are, where, you know, today most people are metabolically ill. 90% of people have at least one metabolic abnormality. Most adults have one chronic disease, and many have several of them. And it's only getting worse. And these are occurring at younger and younger ages. So now we're seeing, you know, teenagers with diabetes and obesity and fatty liver and all these markers of a common underlying metabolic disease. And so something has to be done. And if the next 4 years this administration is going to pay attention to it, then more power to them. So I'm optimistic. Hopefully they'll make the right decisions and, you know, won't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Because I mean, hey, it's always a balance between regulation, you know, and that, you know, the FDA is there for a reason, and, you know, we don't want to have, you know, no regulation, but, you know, maybe it's time for a correction here, just for, you know, for all the reasons we've talked about. So I'm curious, I'm open-minded, and, you know, many, many people in this space are, you know, helping out already in Washington and getting involved. So it's, you know, I think we're seeing some smart people that are going to be involved with this administration, and hopefully it'll become a bipartisan thing that everybody gets behind.
Yeah, he put something out on his website where people can nominate individuals to be a part of the administration. And I might nominate myself, to be honest, because last time we spoke, one of the things that we talked about was the importance of health and wellness coaching to solve some of these health crises that we're facing. And I am really hoping we're about to see the boom of something like that, more health and wellness coaching, so people can actually work on their lifestyle. I think that'd be a great thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you're doing, Mike, is that is really the solution. I mean, even though I'm a doctor, I'm a medical doctor, I know as a patient and as a doctor that doctors don't make me healthy. Doctors just make me less sick. And if I want to be healthy, that's something I have to do with myself, with my lifestyle. And the way, you know, for many of us, the way to do it is through a coaching program, where we get the support, we get the community, we get expertise. But, you know, that expertise isn't coming from a doctor's visit in 7 minutes, you know. It's a much more more long-term project. And the other thing I realized from this book too was that coaching is really, really important, because getting our lifestyle in order before we have the disease diagnosis is really paramount. In other words, one thing that I realized that I didn't really appreciate as, you know, as a medical school professor for so many years, and many of my colleagues still don't appreciate, is that the type 2 diabetes doesn't begin when the doctor says, oh, you know, your glucose is, your HA1C is above a certain point, you have type 2 diabetes. Or, oh, you know, you forgot your keys. Well, you know what? You have Alzheimer's, you know, or, oh, you have calcium in your coronary arteries, so you now have heart disease. In other words, these diseases don't start when the doctor diagnoses them. It's now known for practically all these diseases, really, that they begin years to decades before the doctor makes the diagnosis. And if we wait for the doctor to tell us we have X, Y, or Z disease, and let's face it, we're all going to get one of those diseases because those are the diseases statistically that we die of. Most, you and I and most of our audience will. So, and you know, no one gets out alive, right? So we're all going to get it. But the point is we want to push it back as far as we can. So the point is that the earlier we start on these lifestyle changes, the evidence is very strong that we can decrease our chance of getting these diseases or at least push them back in time so that they occur later in our life and we have a longer health span.
So going back to diabetes for a second, let's say I cut out carbs completely. I'm trying to do the right thing. At least I can have artificial sweeteners and at least I get that little bit of sweetness, right?
Two things. First of all, cutting out carbs is really important for insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes driving that. But that's not the whole story. We can also drive it with seed oils and inflammation can drive insulin resistance. We can also drive it with non-dietary factors and sleep deprivation. You know, famous study, take healthy college students and they sleep deprive them. And within a number of hours, they become insulin resistant on their way to diabetes. You know, it basically messes with their metabolism. Similarly, cortisol and stress can change our metabolism and move us towards type 2 diabetes with insulin resistance. Exercise and other things as well. So carbohydrates are fundamental, foundational. They have to be done, but we have to get our whole lifestyle in place. Now, your question about sweeteners is really, it's really a good one. There, it's, you know, there are different points of view on this. The absolutist point of view is that, well, the sensation of sweetness, whether it's from actual sugars or non-calorie sugar substitutes or even other type of artificial sweeteners, or even thinking about sweetness will trigger an insulin response, a cephalic response, so-called. And, you know, and many times these purists say, well, really, you know, the best thing is not to just, you know, switch to, of course, don't switch to Diet Coke, you know, I mean, or even sugar substitutes, but we cut out sugar and then we lower our, we raise our sensitivity to sugar, just like we do our insulin sensitivity. But what it means is, you know, when I was eating junk food and candy all the time, you know, I'd eat an apple and it would taste like cardboard, you know, and so I had no interest in it. But now, when I'm on low carbohydrate diet, I'm not eating sugar. I bite into an apple and it's like a symphony of flavors. It's so, you know, it's joyous, it's sweet, it's, you know, this whole thing. So it makes me appreciate much, much lower sugars than, you know, any, you know, a little bit of fructose and glucose in the fruit is amplified. So you could make the argument that, you know, the best thing to do is just stop eating sugar or eat a lot less sugar. And you'll appreciate sugar when you get it and you'll kind of dial it down. Now, other people say, well, no, I need it to get off the sugar. It helps me. It's a crutch. And, you know, fair enough. And there, you know, there's some sugar substitutes that are really bad for you and some that are actually pretty good that, you know, that are not harmful and that may even have positive GLP-1 type effects in them even, you know, so. You can go in there. And of course, there are other crutches to get off sugar too, other than just sugar substitutes. You know, some coaching programs are now using low dose naltrexone, you know, for sugar addiction. It's an addiction drug for other types of addiction. But when people on on with sugar addiction or junk food addiction, they take this low dose naltrexone, which works on the dopamine habit pathways. It helps them get off sugar. And
what if simply mastering your breath could unlock greater mental clarity, stress resilience, and physical control? Created by Erwan LaCour, who has been on the show twice, breath hold work is a powerful meditation practice designed to push the limits of your body and mind. This transformative approach has elevated my own mindful practice and helped many of my clients achieve deeper focus and stress relief. Breath hold work offers online courses and live programs to guide you through this empowering journey, no matter your experience level. Ready to tap into your full potential? Check out Breath Hold Work through the link in the show notes. By supporting them, you're also helping the podcast continue to deliver great guests and life-changing content. So please check out the link below. Hey, do you spend a lot of time looking at screens like your phone, the TV, the computer? Well, that can actually lead to some pretty severe disruption in your circadian rhythm, which messes with your sleep, your hormones, your energy, your mood, your clear-headedness. It can actually disrupt quite a bit. Well, Boncharge has life-changing solutions to enhance your well-being and prevent some of those issues. Their blue light blocking glasses, which I'm actually wearing right now, have honestly transformed my life and even the lives of many of the people I work with. I regularly hear how quickly people's sleep improves once they start using these glasses at night. Plus, their red light therapy devices and other wellness products offer cutting-edge health benefits. With the holiday season just around the corner, it's the perfect time to invest in your health or give the gift of wellness to someone special. Right now, there's actually huge discounts during their biggest sale of the year. So click the link in the show notes to shop and support the show, because every purchase helps me keep bringing you great guests and impactful content. Now back to the show.
Even more interestingly is these GLP-1 agonists that, you know, it's a new class of peptides. We've been hearing about them, things like Ozempic or, you know, semaglutide is one group, tirzepatide is another one. And then there are, you know, numerous brand names. They were originally developed as an injection for obesity, and they work. You know, people lose weight on these. And it was thought they do work by creating a sense of satiety, decreasing gastric emptying, and slowing down the GI tract a little bit, which works. But then people noticed, and interestingly, they were given to obese people, and it lowered their risk of they lost weight, but they also improved their diabetes, cardiovascular disease, even Alzheimer's disease. Now all the way across the metabolic spectrum. But people are saying, well, you know, if you take any obese person, obesity itself is a risk factor for, you know, obesity is now replacing tobacco as the number one environmental risk factor for cancer, you know, and it's also, you know, heart disease, all of the metabolic diseases, even mental illness, obesity is a huge factor. So if you just get people to lose weight, they're going to improve all those. Fair enough. But then they started figuring out if you take people who aren't overweight, start giving them these GLP-1 agonists, like type 2 diabetics who aren't overweight, they actually can reverse their type 2 diabetes. Now it's FDA approved for that. And then they're still having these downstream effects. And what they're figuring out is it's not just these drugs just don't work on the stomach, but they also work on the brain, and they decrease neuroinflammation. And people talk about, well, it changed my relationship with food. So it's not that I just feel full. I don't want to eat the junk food anymore or any kind of food. But then it goes beyond that. Some people report, wow, it changed my relationship with alcohol. So I don't want to drink anymore. It changed my relationship with cigarettes. It changed my relationship with other addictive behaviors. So people are starting to, you know, look at GLP-1 agonists for, you know, many, many different metabolic causes, including, you know, junk food addiction at some level. It can be very powerful, but it should never be. People are saying, well, you know, you say, Dr. Leffie, you say pills and surgery don't work, you know, lifestyle works. Now you're saying what, GLP-1s work on metabolic disease? Well, they only work if you change your lifestyle. In other words, if you're obese and you're fat and you take a GLP-1 agonist, you're eating a lot of junk food, you will eat less junk food and you will lose weight, but you'll be thin and metabolically unhealthy. So, and you may not get off the GLP-1s. You'll be on them for life, and you may have sunken eyes, and you know, we've all seen the GLP-1 faces. But if you combine these powerful drugs with lifestyle, things like that you're doing in your program, things like exercise, specifically strength training, and also nutrition, specifically protein, then we save our muscles, we change our lifestyle, and then we can taper off the drugs, and our lifestyle is really what's driving us eventually long term.
I appreciate that perspective, because I've had many other doctors on the show, and actually four of them have spoken about Ozempic, and I'm taking clips from each of those episodes for, you know, an Ozempic special, I guess. So I'll be sure to stitch your take in there as well. And I get calls every day from people who want to know if I administer Ozempic or if I help people who are taking it. Many of the people I already work with have started taking it. It does seem to be all the rage. And, you know, I do think some people out there could benefit from it, as you discussed. And I also think there's plenty of people out there who really have no business even thinking about it because they're not doing anything with their lifestyle, and they absolutely could. They're just looking for the easiest thing right now. I think there's certainly a lot of that. But I am like, so you mentioned some of the artificial sweeteners might be better than others. From the research I've done, it looks like aspartame is probably amongst the worst. I've seen stevia is better, but still could possibly compromise the liver. Xylitol, I've seen some oral health benefits. Some people claim that it can reverse cavities. And finally, monk fruit, I think, has shown benefits for liver enzymes in people who have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. I'm pretty sure I got all that right, but do you have any reference?
Yeah, I mean, anything you can do to decrease your fructose is going to improve your non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and monk fruits can certainly do it. And even the GLP-1s now, one of the things they can do is in some studies association with decreased fatty liver disease. But the other one, I agree with what you said. The other one that I would mention is allulose, which interestingly is also has benefits, and some studies indicate some of the benefits may be similar to these GLP-1 peptides, GLP-1 agonist peptides, so which is fascinating.
Yeah, that is fascinating. Now, let's say somebody is really working on their health. Maybe they want to avoid the artificial sweeteners. They want to keep the carbs in for now. And so they're taking their white rice and they're taking their bread and they're putting it in the freezer, which is something I've been seeing a lot of online, with the argument being that by freezing it and then thawing it and cooking it, it increases resistant starch, which makes it less in calories and a lower glycemic effect. Is that true, or is that some kind of propaganda out there?
Yeah, I mean, the glycemic effect is really important. That's like how fast the glucose hits your system. You know, and the famous study with you take an apple and you put on a glucose monitor, which I'm wearing right now. I recommend them for everybody. Now you can buy them over the counter for the first time in history in the United States now. But yeah, the glucose monitors are great. How's mine doing here? Anyway, that's, you can read out your glucose in real time there. But the famous study about spiking glucose and glycemic index is you take an apple, you eat the apple, and you get a little bit of spike of glucose. Then you take that same apple and you crush it, you grind it up, and you make applesauce out of it. Eat right. The same amount of applesauce, you get a much bigger spike. And then the worst way, of course, is to juice it. You know, you basically take apple juice, throw away all the fiber that's slowing, non-soluble and soluble fiber that's slowing uptake, and then you get a huge spike like that. So that spike is correlated with the glycemic index, and anything we can do to lower the spike. I mean, fascinating. Interestingly, there's a drug for diabetics called acarbose, and it's it's basically, it's a drug that you take, and it really just works in the gut by slowing the absorption of carbohydrates and flattening that spike. It doesn't really act in the body other than in the gut. So, but famously, acarbose was looked at as a longevity drug in something called the Interventions Testing Program, which is sort of the gold standard for longevity. It's where rapamycin really shines as the ultimate longevity drug, the most powerful pharmaceutical intervention. But when they combined rapamycin, well, acarbose had a small effect on longevity in this study on the mice. When they combined rapamycin and acarbose, they got a synergistic effect greater than rapamycin or acarbose alone. So something about slowing that glycemic peak with acarbose or with, you know, any of the other things like having a low glycemic index will, in this study at least, improve longevity even. And there are other tricks you can do to lower the glycemic index. People talk about, even if you don't change what you eat, if you just change food order. So like never, ever start with glucose or eat your carbs first. Always eat your fat or protein first if you can, and then eat the carbs later, because then the fat and protein will slow the absorption of the carbs, flatten the glycemic index, and make you more metabolically healthy that way. So have your cheese before your dessert or whatever.
Yeah, interesting. How about you? Do you have a take on raw milk?
You know, I'm curious about raw milk. I haven't started doing it myself. So I'd be curious on your experience. I could see the advantages of it, and you know, I'm looking forward to diving into it more myself. But what's your take on it?
Well, I was really apprehensive when I started it. You know, I saw it on social media, and I'm just a curious person who's willing to experiment with his health. So I said, you know what? It's all around me. Why not? So I went out and got some. I was blown away with how good it tastes. To me, it's almost as good as ice cream, because it's, you know, it's cold, and it, like, after you drink it, it has that same sort of after effect. And so for a while, once I used that to replace my sugar cravings, I was drinking a gallon of raw milk a day, which is probably not the best, like 2000 calories, but, and plus lots of carbs too. But it definitely helped me transition out of those chocolate chip cookie cravings. And it is now a staple, even, you know, I'm, I guess not strict carnivore, because I eat one steak every day, but I have the raw milk too. And it's been a pretty positive experience.
Nice, nice. I'm definitely going to, that's on my list of things to dive into.
Yeah, well, with the way RFK Jr. is talking, it sounds like you might be seeing that more in grocery stores instead of the pasteurized milk, but we'll see. And speaking of RFK Jr., someone he often criticizes, I follow your social media, and I saw a few posts about Bill Gates. And I'm wondering if you have beef with Bill Gates, pun intended.
No, I mean, there's a lot of policy issues and, you know, political things about Bill Gates. And, you know, there's a whole thing with that. I mean, I think I posted with Bill a couple pictures, not fat shaming him, but just as an illustration of what metabolic disease looks like in a male. It's basically, we've all seen it, you know, but it's fairly characteristic. It's large breasts, sort of man boobs, and then a large stomach. And there's some pictures where, you know, where he was looking a lot like that. And I think I posted them, and, you know, Elon went through a phase like that too, you know, where he was, you know, when something we all could do. I mean, that's the male side of it. And, you know, females have their own version, but I love the one person or a number of people pointed out that if you look at ancient Egyptian iconography and their pictures, a lot of their people are depicted with the men with breasts and large stomachs, almost with this metabolically unhealthy pattern. And then, but then they pointed out that the Egyptians famously existed on wheat. It was a key component of their diet. And wheat, of course, is high carbohydrate. It's, you know, it's grain. So it's going to drive inflammation as well and metabolic disease. Also, the Egyptians famously had a lot of dental cavities problem, but they think that's related to the wheat also. But it, But anyway, back to your question on Bill Gates. No, it was more just kind of illustrative as a famous public figure with at one point, you know, a model for metabolic disease as far as the body was concerned. I wish him no ill and hope, you know, hopefully he gets over it.
Yeah, for sure. And I have no beef with, well, that's actually not true. I have a little beef with Bill Gates. That's a separate episode. You know, another interesting thing I saw on your social media, and this really isn't related to health, although maybe I could make it. I saw a picture at Burning Man. Were you at Burning Man?
You know, I haven't been since my kids were born, but over the years, yes. It's a great place. Do you go?
No, I've always wanted to. It looked like all the art installations, the culture, it seems really cool. And that's definitely on my bucket list.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And of course, now it's live streamed every year on video, which is, you know, kind of not the way to see Burning Man. But but for people who want a taste of it, it is, you know, it is truly unique on this planet. The, you know, the spectacle, the pageantry, the, you know, just the primal energy of the thing and all the art. And, you know, it's something different for everybody when you go there. Nobody has the same experience. And, you know, you make it what you make it. But yeah, I highly recommend it for anyone who's curious.
Well, when I decide to go, I'll hit you up and we'll set up a camp on the playa.
All right, definitely. We'll get an art car built or something.
Yes. Yeah, perfect. Well, in the interest of winding down here, because I know we're almost at time, I want to leave the audience with some practical takeaways that they can really apply beyond what we've discussed, beyond what's in your book. I'm wondering, how can someone really make sure they're finding a good doctor that they can actually trust?
That's a great question because, you know, it's not enough just to be an MD, you know, because, you know, as we've talked about, there are different points of views that different MDs have different philosophies. So typically my orientation is increasingly along the lines of integrative or functional medicine. Doctors tend to holistic doctors who get a root cause, but people, this is one of the main questions I get asked, and we're actually putting together a list now that we're going to have on the website, or we'll put it in the newsletter when it's available, but it'll be city by city, just, you know, if there are people we recommend and doing it that way. But it's really important that you find a doctor that resonates with your own philosophy. And in writing this book, the book was intended, it's not a textbook. It's intended for regular people to read. It's got a lot of pictures in it and diagrams and photos of me and my dog and stuff like that. But in addition, anytime I make a health claim or an opinion, because it's not really my opinion, it's just I try and reference a peer-reviewed article. So there are a lot of references in the book. Mercifully, they put at the end, but there's like 400 references. But it's designed so that, and several people have done this, that they take the book and they give it to their doctor and say, hey, what do you think of this? And then the doctor can read it and they don't have to know who I am or anything, but they can look at the references and say, oh, that does make sense. I agree with that. Or no, he's interpreting that wrong or something. But that's a way to approach it for sure.
Okay. So what advice would you have for the doctors themselves or maybe even medical students?
Yeah, the medical students, I think it's be open-minded and, you know, look at books like this or look at, you know, I'm not the only one, obviously, in this space, but, you know, look at integrative medicine, functional medicine, root causes. Metabolic disease is not getting the attention that it should as a root cause for all those chronic diseases. You know, in many ways, those diseases, the whole list that we talked about, are really just symptoms of an underlying metabolic disease. And if you treat the metabolic disease, in many cases, the other manifestations of them will improve. And that's a new approach to medicine that hopefully more and more students will be embracing and doctors too. It's not too late. Hey, look at me. You know, you can always change your views, and hopefully we're always learning. And, you know, and what we're talking about today, and, you know, in 5 years we'll be going, whoa, I can't believe we said that. You know, now we really know how it works. And of course, that will change 5 years later after that.
That's how it goes. Well, what else have we not talked about today that maybe we should?
Wow, that's a great question. One thing people say is, boy, you've written this book. It's so critical of Western medicine. Don't you get depressed, you know, with these diseases? And actually, I'm not depressed. It's actually, I feel hopeful. I feel like we're entering in a new era of healthcare where the patient is in charge and the doctor is just, you know, giving advice. Because like we talked about, lifestyle is not something a doctor can do for me. You know, I do it with, you know, a coach like you and a program, a community and myself, but a doctor is not going to tell me to do it. So it's a chance for us to take control, take agency of our lives, our lifestyle. Every morning when I get up, I get to decide, you know, what I'm going to eat, when I'm going to eat, when I'm going to exercise. And that's really empowering, because for most of us, I believe lifestyle is the most powerful medicine we will ever experience, even more than the pills and surgeries that were offered.
Well, folks, the book is Lies I Taught in Medical School by Dr. Robert Lufkin. So, Doc, where can people find out more about you and your work?
Oh, thanks, Mike. My website is robertlufkinmd.com. And if you want, you can download a free chapter of the book in audio and a PDF form, so you can see if you like it before you go to the library or buy it somewhere. I'm very active on social media. My wife says too active. So, but look for me there and say hi.
I will put the links in the show notes below. Again, folks, I highly recommend checking out this book. It's really great. But other than that, stay healthy, stay awake. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Please remember to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple. Or if you're watching this on Rumble or YouTube, please be sure to give us a thumbs up and leave a comment down below. Let us know what you thought or if you had any questions based on what we talked about in this episode. And of course, it couldn't hurt to share it with your friends, those who maybe are awake or those, of course, who are waking up. Thanks again. Stay healthy. Stay awake.